Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Vernon Burton discusses the idea of Southern identity. The class examines the history and culture of the American South, from colonial times through the Civil War and Reconstruction to the 1960s Civil Rights era and up to the modern day. This two-hour-long class took place at Clemson University in South Carolina. We joined the class just after Professor Burton finished going over the course schedule.
Now, with the Civil Rights Movement having supposedly settled the race issue, and with the South opened to massive inflows of outsiders, some may ask, what possible basis could there be for a continuing examination of Southern distinctiveness or regionalism? A 2001 Southern Focus poll administered by the Odom Institute at the University of North Carolina and sponsored by the Atlanta Journal and Constitution and the Center for the Study of the American South suggests that Southerners in 2001 see themselves in terms of globalism. The question asked whether Southerners saw themselves primarily as different from non-Southerners or as linked to people around the world. Nearly half of respondents answered connected to people around the world. Fewer than a third of those surveyed viewed themselves primarily in terms of their difference from non-Southerners as opposed to an identity vis-a-vis the nation, a stance the South seemingly has held since 1830s. Does it make sense if we are now moving into a global transnational world to study the South today? And I would argue that Southern history is probably in trouble today. Some of the best and brightest of the young scholars today, born since implementation of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, are arguing that Southern exceptionalism is a myth. In 2006 at Emory, they held a conference that they called The End of Southern History. And you as a class now have read, and we've argued about this edited book, The Myth of Southern Exceptionalism. But to paraphrase Mark Twain, I believe that Southern history's demise has been prematurely proclaimed. As we ponder this problem of the myth of Southern exceptionalism, I'm reminded that Stephen Colbert in the Colbert Report said that rewriting history is a good thing because we can make it better. He recommended that now that an African American is president, we can say that slavery never existed. Now, although done in humor by Colbert, there are indications that not only in the history profession, but in the court of popular opinion, as well as some justices on the federal court and even the Supreme Court, this is some degree happening. Knowing our history, then, is essential for democracy. While history is an interpretation, a construction, so to speak, it matters what foundation you use for this construction. And remember, the three little pigs and the difference the building materials each had made for them. Just so, I think the historical narrative, the interpretation, has to be based on data. If we put up the cricket we've looked at before. Now, when I've asked people what this is around the world, they usually say a grasshopper, but it's a cricket, a brim bait in the South. Now, what fascinates me is why we consider it an insect in America. In Thailand, in fact, people consider it a delicacy. In Taiwan, they, in fact, use it as a pet, like a dog or cat. Let's go to the next one. The point is the perspective you bring to something. Your cultural differences make all the difference in the world in your interpretation. Can everybody read the Calvin cartoon? Maybe I should read it. Calvin is flattering his teacher about how great education is. Go ahead, Jonathan. And the teacher, without knowing anything there at all, knows that Calvin did not do his homework today. And the point again here is, I think, that's very important for us, is history is about context. It's about not just taking a document by itself, but seeing it in its context. The reason the teacher knew what Calvin was all up to is because, in fact, she had worked with Calvin and knew Calvin's history and seen him in context over time. Jonathan, let's go to the other. I want to thank Jonathan Hepworth, who was helping me with the slides today in the classroom. This one particularly appeals to me because this is an older man, and he is assuming, in fact, that this beautiful young woman, go ahead, is thinking that he's really hot. And instead, she says, I don't know what he's acting like that for. He reminds me of my grandfather. And particularly as we look at Southern history, I think this is important because too often I believe that white people have assumed they knew what black people thought. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And I think you can't assume that as good historians. You have to move forward. Historian Jack Green, who was interested in, quote, mainstream the history of the Southern colonies in order to rescue them from the parochial confines of Southern history, found that the model throughout colonial America, with some few exceptions in New England, privileged the pursuit of individual domestic happiness over all other cultural goals. In other words, the early South was not distinct and not peculiar. Now, today, some might find this same model of individualism prevailing over the good of the community and conclude again that Southern conservative values are prevailing. But again, is this the South taking over America, or is it the South is America, or have we now come full circle to our beginnings? Edmund Morgan concluded his influential book on colonial Virginia, American Slavery, American Freedom, with a similar conundrum. Was the vision of a nation of equals flawed at the source by contempt for both the poor and the black? Is America still colonial Virginia writ large? More than a century after Appomattox, the questions linger. And Morgan wrote that in 1975, and I think it's still appropriate to think about today. Still, in the literature on American history, the South frequently appears as an exception to generalizations about national character and about historical trends in the United States. And I want to pay a little bit tribute to my own intellectual heritage from two PhD advisors, Jim McPherson and Sheldon Hackney, who I started studying with in 1969 in graduate school at Princeton, and whose ideas I think are just as relevant today as they were then. McPherson wrote, "Perhaps it was the North that was different, the North that departed from the mainstream of historical development, and perhaps therefore we should speak not of Southern exceptionalism, but of Northern exceptionalism." Sounding very much like Jack Green, though McPherson wrote this first. Still, according to Hackney, Southerners, I quote, "traditionally have had to define themselves in opposition to a presumed American norm. And I believe the South has earned the reputation as the great exception. This is true, except in the South. In the United States, and even if the South's history and values might have been more in line with the rest of the world than the North's. The South, therefore, I argue, is worthy of study, and not only because it's intrinsically interesting, students of American history can benefit by study of its perceived opposite. Now, I believe that each generation does need to figure out its own interpretation, its own identity, to bring its own perspectives to bear on historical issues. And I believe we can still learn from our study of the South, not just about Southern history, but about the history of the United States and certainly the world." In 1928, given his enduring interpretation, U.B. Phillips wrote that, quote, "the central theme of Southern history was the conviction that the South, quote, shall be and remain a white man's country." Phillips' student, David Potter, wrote that Phillips' investigation always led him, as he himself said, back to one feature of life in the South, which was constant before and after, namely the presence of African-American people and whites whose destiny were inextricably intertwined, but whose past and life were separated by a racial system. Now, I want to look at Southern identity with you a little bit as an exploration of the South as other and the Southerner as stranger. By using the framework of the stranger or other, I hope we can find a way to reimagine the South in American history. Through exploring the idea of the other, both from the perspective of the American South, as how the South has viewed the North and how the North has viewed the South, as well as the internal dynamics of how blacks and whites have identified themselves and each other within the South over time, as well as older groups such as Native Americans and newer or at least different groups such as Hispanics or Asians. We will do very little with class here. There's a whole separate lecture that I have that I like to call Trotsky and Trot Lines, or class and classiness, but we'll mention class. We're going to look primarily at race and the internal South. But I hope to illustrate the other as a theme for understanding Southern history. Now, Winthrop Jordan said that there were two fixed points from which the English settlers could triangulate their own position in America, that of the Indian and the black. Or I prefer my PhD student, Dr. Troy Smith of Tennessee Tech, has refined these markers of African-American and Native American, and he says that blacks are the defining point and the Indians are the refining point for white identity in the South. And any student of the South soon learns that there is no such thing as one geographical South. So we have a blank map here. Now, cartographers might include only the 11 Confederate states in their notion of the South. But many a Kentuckian, including Abraham Lincoln, would resent this exclusion. Lyle Lovett, performing in Champaign, Illinois in 1996, announced that Texas and the South, Texas ain't the South. But another Texan, Sissy Spacek, identifies strongly with the South and claims that being Southern is a state of mind. I think maybe it's about having home and family at the center of your world. And that's her quote, and you're going to hear it reflected in literature as we move on with this lecture. Spacek agrees with many Southerners who identify place and home as vitally important to their lives. Asked why, having grown up in Texas, she selected to live now outside of Richmond, Virginia, she explained that that was where her husband was reared, and she went back with him. Besides, quote, "My mother always told me that Virginians settled Texas." In the first book I wrote, In My Father's House Are Many Mansions, I really explored this idea of the meaning of place and community and family among black and white Southerners, particularly looking at how religion influenced their values. And I believe that Spacek is actually onto something about the South. Even today, I think the South is much more child and children focused, as something left over of that rural heritage, a cultural holdover. Indeed, when a poll was conducted and people identified themselves as Southerners, portions not only of Texas and Florida, Michael, you can help us out. What's the county now in which the Trayvon Martin incident has occurred? What's the name of the county? If I hadn't asked you, that's all right. But about there, Michael has pointed out, is where the sort of line goes that people consider the South in Florida. And parts of Virginia said they were not Southern, but there were pockets of Southerners in New York, Chicago, Indianapolis, and Detroit. University of North Carolina students surveyed omitted Arkansas, to chagrin of many who mocked America's was called first black president, Bill Clinton. Black here being a marker or signifier for non-Southerners for Southern characteristics. I also want to remind the class that Lincoln, too, was condemned, in fact, as a black Southern president. So place and locale matter to where people identify themselves as from. When I asked students at the University of Illinois where they were from, what I would be told is they were either from Poland or from Romania or from India or Japan or China. When I ask students here at Clemson where they're from, they tell me they're from Greenwood, South Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, or Royston, Georgia. In other words, they identify place as opposed to ethnicity, and that still goes on today, and I think it's telling us something. So where should then we locate the South? Do we define it by the presence of kudzu? If we do, we got to be worrying with global warming or change, more properly. I think kudzu is probably creeping northward. By urban-rural percentages, by racial proportions, and we'll look more closely at that because I think that is a real key to it. By the omnipresence of the word Dixie in the phone book, by the proliferation of Confederate flags and monuments to the Confederate dead, states named in country music where people read the magazine Southern Living, the lack of dentists, strong racial bloc voting in presidential elections, and you could even say sweet tea, but of course sweet tea now with McDonald's is certainly moving throughout the country as well. Now cotton is clearly important in defining the South. Cotton needs 200 days before frost, and that helps define the South. Some might want to define the South according to the climate, but Southern climate is diverse as the North unless we consider the climate of opinion and the political climate. Still, the overlay of cotton production would give you a map of rural and high proportion of African Americans to the population. Now, this is a painting by Degas from 1873, and it's about cotton. These are cotton factories. And what I want you to note is what? First, all the leisure that's there. There are no African Americans. There's none of the toil that went into producing the crop. It leaves out the hard stuff. And I think that's part of the mythology that we have developed about the South, particularly of the plantation South. Let's go to the next. These is just a reproduction of what a slave ship was like. And you get an idea of how many people were just put together in one place to come over in these cramped conditions to come over all the time. Let's do the next slide, Jonathan. This is an actual picture of a Union soldier, an escaped slave, who is joining the Union Army, and they took a photograph, and you can just see the scars on his back to give you some idea of the other side of the picture that we have of what slavery is like or was like with cotton that we sort of don't see normally in the way the South is, in fact, packaged with the myth of the plantation South. Let's move forward. This is, in fact, comes from Jonathan Hepworth put it together, inspired by a lecture by Bruce Dane, who also worked with Jim McPherson at Princeton. And what it does is sort of looks at the population as well as religion. And, you know, we think that the U.S., the early U.S. was a British colony, but so was Canada and so was the Caribbean. And you can sort of do gradations coming down from the shortest growing season, little agriculture, high religious, few slaves, all the way down to the Caribbean, where you have a large-scale plantation agriculture, the least religious, and slaves and Africans outnumber whites at the time. And you can see those gradations there. And I think that's a key for us, in fact, to understand the South. And we'll come back and look at some more details of that later. Let's go ahead, Jonathan. All right, this is the percentage of slaves and population by county. Keep moving forward. You can see this concentration. Notice where the concentration is. 1870 after the Civil War, and then 1880, you still see the concentration of where the African American population is, similar to where it was with slavery. 1890, the sort of Nader period we're going to talk about. Go ahead. And even 1960, you see, starting even from above Chicago, you still have the heaviest population concentration proportion of African Americans is still in this southern region. Go ahead. This is Ancestry in 2000, if you can read it. And these are people who claim they are African American. Is your bluish? You can see that they are there, again, still concentrated in the South. And you see the pockets of those that are called American as well. Do you want to move on to the next one? And this sort of overlay of the Americans and others together gives us an idea. And here is from the 2000 census. And what we've done is overlaid it with a table that you saw in John Shelton Reed's book that you read, and looking at a study of Southern versus American entries in phone books. And if you look, you can see it gets up to 60% in the sort of the same area where you had the black population, and then you move gradations out away from there. So there's something key about the area that we've identified as both the Confederacy, the Old South, the Cotton South, and I think that's the black population as well as other entries that can go along to correlate with it. Well, early on, let's go on to Jefferson. Early on, Southerners contrast themselves to Northerners. In 1785, the quintessential Southerner, Thomas Jefferson, explained to the Marquis de Chateau sectional differences in character. Yankees were, quote, cold, sober, laborious, independent, jealous of their own liberties, and just to those of others, interested. And what he means by interest there is like bank interest, that they, in fact, were involved in finances, chicanering, superstitious, and hypocritical in their religion. Southerners, such as Jefferson, the person who's writing this, of course, were, quote, fiery, voluptuary, indolent, unsteady, zealous for their own liberties, but trampled on those of others, generous, candid, without attachment or pretensions to any religion but that of the heart. According to this unbiased Southerner, Jefferson, the people of the South were more natural, unrestrained, and in touch with their own souls and with nature. Difference, of course, does not create an other, but difference is a prerequisite for such a creation. From the spring of 1992 through the spring of 2001, University of North Carolina sociologist John Shelton Reed completed 18 national surveys with questions like the very one that we talked about on globalization at the beginning of this talk. You may recognize some of these stereotypes of Northern and Southerners that have come out. There were certain traits that were attributed equally to both Northerners and Southerners by the respondents of the survey. Americans thought of both Northern and Southerners as friendly, hospitable, polite, nice, and unethical. It's sort of hard to know just how Southern those traits are since they're generally attributed to people in other sections as well as the South. Non-Southerners, though, thought of Southerners as people who take life slower and who don't worry much. These non-Southerners also thought of Southerners as lazy, shiftless, and unambiguous. Non-Southerners, we're thinking of Southerners, refer to tradition, cultures, to different speech patterns. On the other hand, they also refer to backwardness, ignorance, and only in the last 15 or 20 years, low class, as opposed to upper class or aristocrat, uneducated, corrupt, insincere, intolerant, bigoted, and segregationist. Sort of a heritage, I think, from the civil rights movement. Southerners, thinking about Northerners, refer to the activity of people in the North, that is, their fast pace of life. People are seen as alive and very lively in the North, as ambitious, better educated, and with very good standards. On the other hand, they thought the Northerners are not religious, they're impolite, they're unprincipled, and their young men are immoral, and most fathers did not want their daughters to marry a Northerner. So these stereotypes appear to have or tend to persist, I think, over the centuries. At least some are still with us today. One of the things that I think you will note is when people in both of these surveys talked about North and South, it seems like they were leaving out African Americans, or when they were lumping them together, the sort of segregation and bigoted thing comes out as a stereotype of a white Southern, but they never say so. It's just as a Southerner. Well, poets and novelists give us clues to the South and Southerners. Often, however, the literary presentations seem to be of strange people doing strange things in strange places, sometimes rather like freaks. We have a list of these from different ones, and my favorite one is on the next page. Can you go to it, Jonathan? And that is Leroy Satchel Page. It says, "Everybody's got any sense is going down south." Southern literary critic Jefferson Humphrey states, "The South is instead nothing in the world but an idea in narrative form, a discourse or rhetoric of narrative tropes, a story made out of substories, a lie, a fiction to which we have lent reality by believing in it." Or as another literary critic, Lewis Simpson, argues, "The North and South need to invent each other in order to invent themselves." In an analysis of the idea that the South is the other and the stranger, the Southerner is the stranger, I notice that the South does not know it is strange until non-Southerners tell it so. The North also sees its own reflection, I think, in the South and projects from that. The inventions are a double consciousness, the dual identities of the South and the non-South, or for African Americans and minorities in the South, such as Native Americans, Asians, and Hispanics, perhaps even a triple consciousness. Southern writers have puzzled about this question of what it was that happened in the South that made the people different. Now, in his 1965 novel, The Liberation of Lord Byron Jones, Jesse Hill Ford captures the obsession with the South about race and the civil rights movement. One of the heroes of the novel, Steve Mundane, is a white Southerner by birth, reared and educated in the South, and now married to a beautiful California girl who is Scandinavian and who, in these days of the civil rights movement that the book is written to cover, has helped to prick Steve's moral conscience. In contemplating the South, he thinks it is a state of mind, quote, "very like democracy or Christianity, motherhood or patriotism and the flag." He thought it was not, quote, "a region, but a way and a means of life to be taken on faith and accepted, to be believed without questioning, for like the existence of God, the existence of the South could not be proved." Ultimately, he decided to call it myth. Authors will often use this sort of counterposition of a place that's far from the South, Scandinavia and California, and of course, Canada is often clearly the one, and that's, you see that a lot in African-American literature too, because Canaan refers often to Canada and the land of ultimate freedom. You can do the same thing with more recent novelists such as Pat Conroy, one of my current favorites. His 1986 book, The Prince of Tides, the Southern male Tom Wingo is telling his family story to his sister Savannah's New York Yankee Jewish female psychiatrist, Susan Lowenstein. So what the authors are doing is trying to pick something that looks different from the South for the people to be telling their stories to. Probably better than anyone, William Faulkner came to grips with what made the South the South. Absalom Absalom deals with the different spiritual qualities of Southerners. Very typically, Absalom Absalom is a story about a story being told. This particular story, told in 1910, is about the Sutphen family, which involves race and racial identity. The story is being told by white Mississippian Quentin Compson, who's wandered up north to Harvard to go to school. He's telling the story to his roommate, Shreve McCannon, a Canadian. Shreve's had difficulty understanding Southerners in the South. Quentin answered him simply, "You can't understand it. You would have to be born there." Finally, late one cold evening in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Shreve finally has a breakthrough and thinks he understands. Shreve concludes, quote, "The South is fine, isn't it? It's better than Ben-Hur, isn't it? No wonder you have to come away now and then, isn't it?" And that brings us to the idea of the Southern protagonist's need to become the literary other or outsider or stranger. An interesting perspective is offered by literary criticism, particularly Edward Said's treatise on Western efforts to grapple with the enigma of Arab Middle East, which he calls the Orient. These Western efforts, which he calls Orientalism, are premised, this is a quote, are premised upon exteriority. He writes, and are products of, quote, the same sense of estrangement experienced by Orientalists as they dealt with a culture so profoundly different from their own. The discourses are, quote, not truth, but representations that are full of condescension and bad faith. Now, historian Mark Block noted that there are two ways of being impartial, that of the scholar and that of the judge. According to Said, quote, to look for a conscious, fair, and explicit judgment is to look in vain. Every European in what he could say about the Orient was consequently a racist, an imperialist, and almost totally ethnocentric. Or in Faulkner's protagonist Quentin's words, quote, you can't understand it, you would have to be born there. Now, I'm reading a quotation now from Said, but I'm substituting in words like North or Yankee for such words as Orientalist, European, and West, and the word South for such words as Orient, Arab, and Mideast. Every statement made by Yankees conveyed a sense of the irreducible distance separating Northern from Southern. Their estrangement from the South simply intensified their feelings of superiority about Northern culture. The Southerner was seen from the cleansing perspective of one not Southern, and one for whom such unself-conscious primitive simplicity as the Southerner possesses is sometimes defined by the Northerners. Northern work in the main has been aggressively ideological despite their various attempts at subtlety and irony. The common denominator is the Northern perspective, seeing Southerners as by nature lacking the desirable qualities of Yankees. Its central argument is the myth of the arrested development of the South and of Southern backwardness, degeneracy, and inequality with the North. Now that's the end of me appropriating that quote and substituting South and North in effect. And the exercise, I think, is interesting, but I'm no more comfortable as Faulkner's Mississippian Quentin as the other than portraying Yankee and other outsider scholars as Shreve. After all, if you've read The Sound and the Fury, as well as Absent and Absent, then we know what happens to Quentin. The obvious response to Edward C. A. Said and Quentin Compson is that if you think outsiders write bad history, why don't you write better history rather than attacking outsiders for being outsiders? There's nothing to prevent insiders from writing good history, but underneath all this terrible rhetoric is a point, I think. Quentin can't tell the story without Shreve. He needs him, and by the end, they're telling the story together. And I think that United States history needs both North and South telling their stories to each other and together. I was once asked when I was teaching at the University of Illinois how I could justify teaching Southern history when our emphasis now was world history, global history, and transnational history. And what I see the difference in history, as I explained to him, is that there's a difference between antiquarianism and history. Antiquarianism is not comparative, but history is comparative. And in order to teach the South, you have to be comparative. You have to look at the North, and I would hope the rest of the world is a way to understand it. Well, even the soundly empirical beginning leaves us difficulties in defining the South. As sympathetic as I am to this mystical quality about the South and about Southerners, I believe that tangible evidence for defining the South from the North is around us every day. You just have to be very sensitive to it. And so I've got this following intellectual exercise that I've taken from Sheila Hibbard's Regional Cookbook. There was Southern cooking before there was Paula Deen. In fact, as early as 1946, Sheila Hibbard complained that all the synthetic mixes and the box recipes that, quote, too much innocence had fled from the kitchen. And I've had the two recipes up. The first one is North Carolina. Can you flip over to the other just so people can look back and forth? You can see there's about half the number, in fact, of ingredients there, which tells you something right away then. So I won't go through all the ingredients, but let me just read quickly the recipes for you. Mix and sift the dry ingredients into a bowl. Cut cut in the butter and vegetable shortening and pour in enough milk to form a soft, workable dough. Turn onto a lightly floured board and working with the hands as little as possible. You notice the idea of the lazy South, working with the hands as little as possible. Roll out to 1/2 inch thickness. Fold the dough over on itself in 3 layers and roll out again. Repeat the process 3 times. You find this throughout the Southern history, these magical threes, whether it's the Ku Klux Klan or the 30 or the sevens or the days that you'll have the number of stripes someone's given. Finally, roll out to 1/4 inch thickness, cut with floured biscuit cutter, and place the biscuits not quite touching each other, making sure that even biscuits were segregated in 1946 in the South. On a lightly greased baking sheet, brush with milk, prick with a fork, and leave in a cool place from 30 minutes to 1 hour. That's another key thing that's different, in fact, in the North and the South. And then you bake in a hot oven from 10 to 12 minutes. Serve as soon as taken from the oven. That's different than the North. They don't say you eat them the minute they come out of the oven. And you get more biscuits, too, than you do in the North. In fact, in the North, they have you working with the fingertips. You pat and knead, and you get less biscuits. So it's just one example of difference in the South and the North. Now, Maya Angelou said, "The black Southerner and the white Southerner are locked to the land and to its history." The African-American novelist says, "A painful history of guilt, cruelty, and ignorance, it clings to us like the moss on trees." And I think the history of the South is entangled in a sense of mystery, that somehow the history of the American South is larger than life. That's bait we use for going fishing down here. The concept of alienation enters this aspect as it includes the outsideness of the South, its role as the other, the legacy of slavery, the peculiar quality of caste and clan in the South, the isolation, the inbreeding of the South, the ability under the most unpromising of circumstance to produce figures of literary rank, both black and white. Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Walter Percy, Ellen Glasgow, you can go on and on. You have this conflict of the persistence of gracious living and the aristocratic style with poverty, the distorted image of the Southern politician, the hope of the civil rights movement, all of them going to give the South a miserable portion of American life. That's Huey Long, the Kingfish. We had time to do some of his Mixie. And of course, I'm a Democrat, a Dixiecrat. That was Strom Thurmond in the 1948. And of course, then George Wallace. And I think it's important as we talk about George Wallace that we also keep in mind that Wallace looked like one thing to people in Michigan and another in Alabama and in Mississippi. And I want to contrast him here with, in fact, John Lewis, who I would highly recommend if you want to read one biography or autobiography of the Civil Rights Movement, his great work, Walking with the Wind, A Memoir of the Movement. And people there had challenged him. You might remember that, in fact, when after Wallace is crippled and shot, he runs again, and it's the black population, in fact, that helps elect him after all he's done in terms of a segregationist and the kind of things he said. And a lot of people couldn't accept that. And I will never forget one of the things that John Lewis said. He says, not, in fact, to accept that someone can change is to deny everything the civil rights movement was about. That's what he was willing to get beat up again and again, his jaw fractured, ribs broken, and go back to prison, always saying that he loved those people who were doing that to him and believed through the power of religion. Again, the importance of religion in the South, that in fact someone like George Wallace could be changed and to become someone who fought for black rights. So whatever you think about Wallace, the person who, in fact, went to jail, I believe, more than anyone else in the civil rights movement, Congressman John Lewis, certainly believes that people can change. Well, I think for people with the South, it's like almost a blind man trying to describe the elephant. It's what you grab hold to. And you have to be careful that you just have one part of the South, in fact, to understand it. The South, as a strange place, has played a dynamic role in the American imagination, the backward, the evil, and the romanticized other, in a United States certain of its innocence, superiority, and power. A major outcome of the Civil War and the subsequent defeat of one nation, or at least a region, by the other, had the effect on both sides of inspiring each to glamorize its superior civilization and to denigrate that of the other as alien, un-American, and lacking in enduring and essential values, in other words, as the other. The Civil War and Reconstruction reinforced the Southern tendency to see the outside world in hostile terms and also added moral insult of defeat. As C. Van Woodward maintained, the white Southerners' loss of innocence and defeat added another ingredient to the South's reservoirs of suspicion and latent animosity. Moreover, the Southern other, once defeated, accepted tragedy as an integral component of his cultural heritage. Some say defeat with its accompanying tragedy of loss was necessary to the successful literary culture of Southern writers. I would also say, though, there's probably even a greater sense of grievance that particularly white Southerners feel. Reconstruction was a brief moment of interracial democracy when the South had an opportunity to become integrated in the national mainstream, but it did not. Now, we're in the sesquicentennial of our Civil War national celebration for when we killed each other. And I reminded some folks a year ago or so on April 14th, Fort Sumter commemoration, that we remember December the 7th, 1941, as a day of infamy. And we don't really celebrate, in fact, September the 11th, 2001. So we want to be careful how we treat the firing on the U.S. flag by Confederate forces, I think, at Charleston Harbor in 1861. Never, in fact, one for Reconstruction have we ever had a celebration. And that fascinates me. Why is Reconstruction, which I think has to be seen, in fact, as part of the long Civil War, that is, Reconstruction has to be included. But we've had celebration after celebration of Reconstruction. Almost every courthouse square has a monument to the Confederate soldier, but we have nothing, as far as I know or have seen, hardly anything to Reconstruction, which I think is maybe more important as to who we are as Americans and understanding it. In fact, a term used for the overthrow of Reconstruction I strongly object to, the idea of redemption. As someone who's a person of faith, I don't like taking a beautiful religion term like redemption and saying this is what we're going to call the overthrow of a legitimate interracial government by violence and terrorism. It makes it sound too, I think, too well. In fact, it's Reconstruction, I would argue, are some of the great heroes we should be honoring, and it was certainly an opportunity for our better angels, as Lincoln termed them, an equality for all, but that's another lecture, so I'll hold off on that. It is this stage of Southern history called the nadir, or the bottom of race relations, when the African American was mostly written out of the public memories of the South, and especially out of the memory of how African American soldiers helped win the Civil War. Black men and women fought the new system, but the official record of the history books are mostly silent on African Americans in this period. The white public officially moved them into a category of other. This period also saw Confederate myth-making of the Lost Cause, the founding of the Daughters of Confederacy, and the erection of statues and monuments to Confederate soldiers. This slide is one, in fact, that comes West Feliciana Parish, where Angola Prison is. And you can see the words there. They fought for the right, for home, and for God. It talks about heroes, but no mention of slavery at all there. The Confederacy may have lost the Civil War, but in the only instance I really know of, the losers of the war wrote the history, and ironically, the rebel soldier ideal began to win in the memory wars. Now, this is Robert E. Lee, of course, if any of you have been on Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia. And I love this particular statue, and I like that they put Arthur Ashe there on Memorial Avenue as well. But I'm reminded of a story here that illustrates, I think, what I'm trying to say. There was a man who loved Robert E. Lee and all the values the great aristocrat Robert E. Lee stood for. And so when his son was born, he took him the first day out of the hospital on that Sunday. He took him to see the Robert E. Lee at on Memorial Avenue and told him about all the qualities of Robert E. Lee. And that became a regular Sunday ritual until the little boy is 7 years old, at which point, as happens in America, his corporation is moving him from Richmond, Virginia, out to California. So he's got the little boy there, and he says to him, "Now, son, I have talked almost every Sunday about the virtues and qualities of Robert E. Lee. Do you have any questions?" The little boy said, "Yes, sir, Daddy." Said, "Who's that man up there on the back of Robert E. Lee?" And I think that's important, especially for us in Southern history, because it does matter who's riding that horse or who's guiding the way it's going and where it's going and telling the story. Well, even today, the rebel has been adopted not only in the South but internationally as a romantic symbol of defiance and a signifier of the other. After all, the rest of the world and the American South do not share the Northern Red American commitment to triumphalism. And white conservatives lost the Civil War, and after white conservatives won the Reconstruction Wars, the South remained the defeated other. Even after the turn of the 20th century, during a period of apparent ideological integration of the nation, a hostile view toward the rest of the world were characteristic of Southerners. The North continued to view the South as the other by dint of isolation and poverty, which was another deviation from the national experience. It was 1938 when President Franklin Roosevelt proclaimed the South the nation's number one economic problem. In fact, Northerners saw the Southern other as backward and lazy. During the Works Progress Administration that came out in a program to get people employed and working when we were having the Great Depression, as we call, one of these New Deal Works Progress books in 1942 had a book of advice where employers traveled throughout the United States. In one sequence, Howard Martin of Illinois had this to say about going into the South in the 1940s, quote, "In plain English, you get lazy. I noticed it. The first 2 weeks I was there, I ate oranges with enthusiasm. Then I got too tired to peel an orange and always bought tangerines. The skins pull off with about two motions. Then I got too lazy to handle the tangerines and ate kumquats the rest of my stay." Now, Erskine Caldwell, even if he wants us to sympathize with the conditions that produced Jeter Lester, produces negative stereotypes for sharecroppers and emphasizes this sense of laziness and indolence. And what we're talking about here now is sort of internal strangers, not just the Yankee outsider. And though I said we wouldn't talk about class very much, we're getting close to it here. These are sort of personalities that are not there. They're sort of stripped down. This is Bud Fields and Alma Mae Burroughs. That's their real names. And they come from a great book by James Agee and Walker Evans, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. And they are sort of insider and outside, native, other, and stranger. James Agee is from Tennessee. Evans is sort of from St. Louis, but really from Chicago. And what you have is incredible writing, but a stripped-down sort of picture as you get sort of an exoticizing and sort of an exclusion of the poor white Southerner and black as a degraded other. In the South, poverty and racism prevailed, and the South as other continued to distort itself by fabricating the African-American as other. Before the Civil War, when white Southerners talked of community, they included everyone in the locale. In particular, some elite white Southerners romantically viewed their plantation as an extended family. In the now famous words of historians Eugene Genovese and Elizabeth Fox Genovese, quote, "Our family, white and black." This part of the plantation mythology has continued. By definition, slavery, however, ruled out segregation. Slavery could not exist without the interaction of blacks and whites, and for that matter, without force there and violence to make people be slaves. With whites serving a policing or military role, whites believed they knew their slaves, although they didn't, and slaves and free blacks had to know whites in order to manipulate the system of slavery for survival. With segregation, however, even these defective interactions ceased. Now, W.E. Du Bois was one of several scholars who noted that as the New South began to urbanize and as the older generation of whites and African Americans who had interacted under the slave system passed away, blacks and whites had less knowledge of each other. That is, they became strangers to each other. With the growth of the all-white textile mill villages in the Piedmont, upcountry regions existed with no interaction between African Americans and Southern whites. Each became the stranger to the other. In my voting research and oral histories, again and again, African Americans would talk about the meanest treatment. The place they were most worried about were these all-white-only enclaves in the mill village. So for all the racial contradictions, there's still a class element that goes there. This was a poem here in Spartanburg, South Carolina, by Peter Moody, making fun, in fact, of cotton mill workers. It almost caused riots as people from the cotton mill went up to Wofford College, where the writer was, to beat up the students there because of the harsh things they were saying about mill workers. You'll notice this about the union. Now, I've often thought that the unions would have done better in the South. They'd been called confederacies of labor, probably, after the Civil War. I worked in a cotton mill, went to work in one when I was 16 in 96, and on the bathroom wall, I saw what it said about unions, and you would not want to join if you believe what it said about unions, what it would do to your wife and children and other things. It was pretty horrible. But there's also, a lot of people don't realize, one of the largest strikes of all time was right here in the South. 7 people were killed at Honeypath. And one of the reasons I think unions did not take is the unions had promised to support the strikers. But then when they struck, there was no food, they lost their jobs, and it caused, I think, a one opportunity when unions could have come into the South, when so many people had become anti-union. The leader of the union that closed down the mills in Greenwood became extremely anti-union because he felt like it had deserted him, that they had promised there'd be support for his wife and children, and they were going hungry. And, you know, brothers who didn't go on strike would sneak food out behind the lines to get to others at the time. Well, the prevalent image of the racist Ku Klux Klan as rural folks burning crosses and terrorizing African American knows the meaning, I think, of Southern rural community. You get this sort of notion both in Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. And the first Klan was rural because most of the South was rural at the time. But really, the Klan in the 1920s really is more at places like Atlanta and not rural, and certainly the 1950s Klan was very urban and town-oriented, or at least with the cotton mills. The latter Klans have been primarily urban and town-centered. And I think this goes because people in rural areas know each other. They share work and other things, but not there. And I just thought this was interesting. This is a women in the Klan marching. So the phenomenon of African Americans as a stranger can be seen in the most heinous symbol of Southern race relations, lynching. The descriptions of lynching often concluded, these are dots. We actually had a different map there, and each dot represents a lynching. So you can see how they're really concentrated in the South, though there are lynchings everywhere. One dot will equal a lynching, and they're really concentrated there. And one of the reasons we did it that way, if you did it by percent of population lynched, a county in Georgia, which has so small counties, looks like there's not as much lynching, whereas South Carolina, which has didn't have many counties, it looks just the opposite, whereas Georgia actually had more lynchings than any other state. So that's why we tried to present it this way, to show it to you. It's a sort of the most horrible sort of and heinous form that you can see about race relations and how it's concentrated so much in the scholar. Now, scholars suggest that most lynchings were not directed indiscriminately at local African Americans, but particularly those who differed in any ways from outside the community. This is a slide from Cairo, Illinois. It's actually a postcard to get an idea how horrible these things were at the time. The universal excuse for lynching, rape, or attempted rape of a white woman by an African American has been made to shown that it was untrue in almost all cases. But part of the construction of racism in the United States was the imputation of male virility to African-American males and association with African-Americans, especially males, with a bestial other. With African-Americans viewed by Southern whites as the other locally, then an unknown black stranger was particularly vulnerable. Lynching occurred in the North as well, but for different purposes. The North wanted to run out African-Americans in the North and form all white communities. White Southerners generally wanted to control black Southerners as laborers. So sundown towns is a phenomenon of the North, not in the South. There are very few sundown towns in the South. One of the things, though, there were times, in fact, when there were purges in the South of counties. There's areas in Florida, movies been done on that, and certainly in Georgia, where African Americans are driven out. It's not clear who is doing this. Is it because of competition? And it gets very confused when a leader, sometimes because they want black workers, are trying to protect and keep African Americans there, and poor whites who are in competition with labor might be involved. So it works both ways. All this time, the rest of the nation, no longer threatened in any way by the South, seemed content to ignore Southern problems, to allow the white South to exploit, segregate, and lynch their African-American citizens. Finally, after decades of African-American struggle against Jim Crow, the civil rights movement benefited, I think, immensely from the new medium of television to capture the imagination of the North. TV showed the effects of segregation and the brutality of repression in images of another America in the South. Again, the white South felt besieged. the counterattack of the Southern press on the self-righteous and the self-hypocrisy of the North in 1960 manifested the defensive mentality of a beleaguered other. And you can see some of these civil rights slides from Greensboro sit-ins to Selma March for the Voting Rights Act. I've often argued that two things changed the South: air conditioning and the Voting Rights Act. And we understand better, in fact, how air conditioning works because we have better education for science than we do for what used to be called civics and history, and how important the vote is, in fact, to making change for people. And the reason I say TV is so important, I think particularly people outside the South and even in the South thought that the reports of violence and terror were exaggerated until they were actually seen. It was brought into their living room, the kind of horrors of a dog attacking someone or fire hoses rolling people down the road and taking skin off of them. The South has served as both the bete noire and at the same time, as many would argue, become the hope and salvation of race relations in the South. During the Civil Rights Movement, I think many people felt the whole United States was just sort of tilted so that all the evils rolled down into the South. The great civil rights voting attorney Frank Parker wrote me about Section 5, that is the preclearance clause of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And I quote, "We could always get a majority of Congress to beat up on the Southern minority. That is why in 1965, 1970, 1975, and 1982, we beat back amendments to make Section 2 coverage nationwide. Even today, many hold a negative view of the South. African-American columnist Bob Herbert in a 1990 piece for the New York Times wrote, "To enter Mississippi has always been, in my view, to descend to a lower place, a world of fanatical race hatred in which blacks were condemned by whites to a perpetual state of humiliation and often gruesome suffering. In this most southern place of all, the Mississippi Delta," Herbert concludes, "whites have always ruthlessly exploited African-Americans." In 2005, while premiering his documentary on Emmett Till, Keith Beauchamp stated, "I was shocked. I found myself on this journey, and I realized very quickly that a certain kind of racism still exists in the Deep South." Our youngest daughter, Alice Ann, who went to the University of Georgia as an undergrad in 2006, used to think that her mother and I were obsessed with race, that she did not see race as a problem, that it was a post-racial society that she was growing up in until she got to the University of Georgia, and she called us up and apologized in terms of the salience of race that still existed then in the South. And I was asked to give a speech at the NAACP at Columbia for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and there was a march. So I was asked to march in the front row in Columbia, and it was about, as you know, even today, South Carolina is still boycotted by the NAACP. That's why we don't have some of the great NCAA tournaments and things that would be coming our way and bringing money into the state now, because even though the Confederate flag has been moved off the top of the state capitol, it sits in front. And so there was a boycott, and I was asked to come. So my daughter came over and marched with me, and people who were holding up signs and sitting to the side were angry, and it really frightened her. It gave her a different perspective. Just last month, when I was in West Feliciana Parish, where I'm an expert witness for the counsel of Mr. Woodfox, who's been in solitary confinement since 1972 in Angola prison, convicted for murder of a prison guard he claims he did not do. Now, two of Mr. Woodfox's counsel were too fearful to even spend the night in the parish, instead making us drive back to Baton Rouge to spend the night. So I think it's this image of the South that still resonates with many people. And I will say that one of these attorneys was not black. At the same time, the presidents who most supported minority rights were white Southerners: Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and I would argue Abraham Lincoln. The success of the civil rights movement, the one person, one vote court ruling, and the enforcement of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act have forced the South, I think, to finally confront its racism. More African Americans are elected and appointed officials at all levels, from local, state, and national, come from the South today. The series of maps that we have a map, if we'd put it there, of where black elected officials come from would be the very same one fitting in that same area. And that image of the racist South is, I think, now being countered by yet another somewhat perhaps mythic image, though I'd like to think it's true. We can talk a little bit about it if we have time. The myth of the South, of a land where blacks and whites get along so much better. Of course, this comes a little close to the plantation mythology of good paternalistic race relations, but I do think it is different. than that people used to protest when they were arguing for segregation, that, you know, people were happy here. And you can see it actually in televisions and movies. You see it in these sort of black savior films where an African-American saves the white, the legend of Bagger Vance. You can see it outside of the South, too, in Eddie Murphy movies. You can see it in Whoopi Goldberg and Karina. It's not just the South that you see these things, but I think there's something interesting going on that helps us about identifying Southern history. And this trope is quite different from the older trope where a great white man from the South stands up and saves, rather passes, and helpless African-Americans. And I don't want to denigrate it because I love the book To Kill a Mockingbird, but you see Atticus Finch defending the black prisoner there. Or more recently, Gene Hackman in Mississippi Burning. And that's partly why so many African Americans are upset with what they see as a female version of that, as a white woman is giving voice in the Help to African Americans. So the second, I'm going to shift from there a little bit, because we can spend more time on it if we have time. But the second principle, I think, that's hard for us to understand in the South are those contradictions. And that might just be another way of describing what Woodward has termed the irony of Southern history. My own favorite example, of course, is none other than Abraham Lincoln. Now, I want to talk just a moment about Suzanne Lloyd Parks. Now, she would deny that she's Southern. If you can't tell which is which, she's the one that's closer to me. She was born in Kentucky, just like Abraham Lincoln, but she would say she's not Southern. She was reared as a military brat, spending part of her youth abroad, and even attended a German-speaking school in Europe. She argues that it taught her, quote, what it feels like to be neither white nor black, but simply foreign. But I think Park actually captures a sense of not only Lincoln's contradictions as a white Southerner and the president who stopped the South from rebelling, but the essence of much of our own struggles with identity as Southerners, black and white, in our own era of post-racial, supposedly, and postmodern history. Now, she's won a Pulitzer, she's won a Tony, and she was a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Suzanne Lloyd Parks is fascinated by the story of Abraham Lincoln, or to be more specific, by the death of Lincoln. While some in the African-American community do not care for her work because of her use of stereotypes, two of her plays have really stunned me. In her 1993 The America play and her 2001 Top Dog Underdog, the latter about family conflict, painful memories, and two brothers who attempt to dominate one another, Parks offers us stories about, quote, the passage of time and, quote, the crossing of space. She writes about a grave digger, the son of grave diggers, digging the huge hole of history. And you graduate students here, that's H-O-L-E, not the hole that Annalise of history would be talking about. History summoned the digger like a memory. And his big hole, he made a theme park where he reconstructed history. His favorite reconstruction was of Abraham Lincoln. Tall and thin, he resembles Lincoln. And when he puts on a fake wart, people pronounce him and Lincoln to be in virtual twinship. Someone told him that he played Lincoln so well that he ought to be shot. And after that, his money-making endeavor was to sit still while a paying customer chose to pistol and shot blanks at the back of his head. They would shout, "Thus to the tyrants," or "The South is avenged," or other assorted remarks such as Robert E. Lee's last words, "Strike the tents." Now, one of her insights into Lincoln was the idea of uncertainty amid a grander, millennial, almost mystical vision of freedom when Lincoln, quote, didn't know if the war was right, when it could be said he didn't always know which side he was on. Not because he was a stupid man, but because it was sometimes not two different sides at all, but one great side surging towards something beyond either Northern or Southern. Parks reminds us of how Americans identify with Lincoln in different ways, how so many of us, especially historians, write ourselves into whom we make Lincoln to be. It's no coincidence then that I argue Lincoln is a Southerner or the greatest theologian of the 19th century. Often it's our better angels, but sometimes it's also, I think, our greatest fears and fantasies that we call into play. Parks also suggests the changing image of Lincoln among African Americans, that he's moved from the great emancipator to the great white honky. That is, Lincoln looked very good when historians were studying slavery. But as we begin to study race with the Civil Rights Movement and racism, we get a different image. And I think Lincoln has been taken out of context a lot. These contradictions also point to the strangeness of the region, I think. The South was one of the earliest settled parts of the United States, yet remains one of the nation's last frontiers. The South's agrarian heritage rests on a deep love for the land, yet from the Civil War on, the South has had the highest proportion and the largest number of landless farmers. Southern love of the land has not meant care for the land. The South has the most soil erosion in the United States. My wife and I just visited the Grand Canyon, and she was just loved the Grand Canyon. It was on her bucket list. It reminded me of the gullies of washed out red soil on our home place in Madison County, Georgia, in fact. And you'll see this slide is in Mississippi of soil erosion. William Faulkner illustrated the Southerner's attitude to land in his essay, Mississippi, where he said, fell on a tree which took 200 years to grow in order to extract from it a bear or a capful of wild honey. So contradiction persists in abundance. The justly renowned Southern gentleness is outdone only by Southern violence. Hospitality coexisted with lynchings and riots. Another saying is that a Southerner will be polite to you up until the very moment they're mad enough to kill you. Can we go on? Do we have our... this is a radio station in Atlanta. Welcome, Southern brother. Go ahead. We'll get our other Lincoln thing. And, of course, this is Radio Free Dixie about Robert F. Williams in North Carolina, the roots of black power. Let's go ahead. A mint julep, sort of getting the idea of Southern hospitality. Let's go ahead. This is my favorite. Can you read it? This is after we had been in South Carolina after 34 years in the land of Lincoln and coming back to South Carolina to teach. The first week, someone gave us this $5 bill and change. And I don't know if you can read across it because it's not in color, but it says Yankees Terrace stamped across Lincoln's face. So somebody's got nothing better to do than deface U.S. currency and things. So I see these contradictions and sort of the hospitality and things there. One finds a predominance of homicide. Can you go ahead, Jonathan? This will be our guns slide and things. Compared to suicide in the South. This is should be our slide on the stand. On take your stand. Oops, wrong one then. Okay. Well, we'll just go ahead with this and I'll come back to that. Violence in the South has been very, very interesting because it's not just black, white on black violence. It's whites killing each other as well. In fact, if you really want to take out your anger on yourself, you'd go to North, which has a lot more suicide. But if you want to take it out on others, you go South where you kill people pretty much. This tradition of violence, and indeed is shown in my hometown of 96 South Carolina. And this is the monument that I grew up with, or the recognition. And I'm going to argue later, we really learn our history not from books like mine, The Age of Lincoln, but from what people tell you is important. That historic house, or in this case, it is celebrating Preston Brooks, who's from 96, of course. Brooks caned Senator Charles Sumner. Brooks assaulted the abolitionist Sumner for a speech that insulted Brooks's kinsman, and he said the state of South Carolina, and I quote Brooks, quote, I struck him with my cane and gave him about 30 first-rate strikes with a gutta-percha cane. Every lick went where I intended. Towards the end, he bellowed like a calf. I wore my cane out completely. And in 1856, a grand assembly in 96 honored Brooks, and the New York Times reported to be the largest gathering ever in the upcountry. At that celebration, thousands of canes were given to Brooks to replace the one that he had been given. And you get a sense of this. So that is what I grew up as understanding. If you want to be recognized and celebrated by your hometown, then you want to beat people up. We had a great football team. We won the state championship because we had been taught those values. Now, 96 is also the home of that's the Brooks Memorial there, and it's actually four generations of historians, C. Van Woodward and Sheldon Hackney and myself, and then some of my graduate students. Go ahead, Jonathan. This is Benjamin E. May's home. It's now been moved, but it was in a field there when I took it in 96, South Carolina, where he was born. Now, there is no memorial to Mays in 96 when I grew up. There's no marker commemorating this apostle of peace, whose very life represented a heroic struggle for dignity and for civil rights. He was proclaimed one of the three greatest theologians of the 20th century. was only in my senior year when I was at Furman University that I heard Dr. May speak at Religious Emphasis Week that I learned that this man, who was known throughout the world, was from my own hometown. The small town, city white fathers, as well as white women's auxiliaries, did not value May's former moral. It was not that he was considered and rejected. He was not even thought of. He was the invisible stranger in the midst of a white political system. This not knowing each other, black and white, was one of the great tragedies of the era of segregation when my generation came of age. The South received a less diverse influence of immigrants compared with the rest of the nation, yet it's a region, in fact, where ethnic polarity has been most noted throughout American history. This region prides itself on its individuality, yet no region is so cursed with conformity of thought and behavior. Of all the sections of the United States, only the South ever rebelled and in open revolt tried to leave the Union, but today the South is the seat of super patriotism. While New England was founded for religious purposes to be a city upon a hill, to show the rest of the world how they could live, the South was the least religious section of the nation during the colonial and revolutionary eras. Now it is a Bible bed and seat of religious fundamentalism, but that's counted by languorous hedonism. It is both terror and tobacco road, cat on a hot tin roof and the color purple. And my favorite example is when I was driving between Houston and Galveston, and there was a strip joint. And it had a big sign, and it was called Heartbreakers, with an outline, a silhouette of a probably a nude woman. And beside it was a Baptist church, which then built a larger sign that overshadowed Heartbreakers and said, "Only Jesus Christ can mend a broken heart." So as you came down the interstate, you saw these two contrasts, I think, that are there in the South. I tried very hard to get a copy of it, but you just can't do it on the interstate very well. It's the image of terror, I think, that has struck most in the American imagination, the aristocratic South. And it's this image that's most dominated and captured the American imagination, the plantation legend of the South. Planters were sort of internally producing this mystification. They mystified themselves, and I think they succeeded. You can see the slide of Gone with the Wind, and this is, in fact, Harriet Beecher Stowe, which was the most popular book of the 19th century in play, and Gone with the Wind was the most popular of the 20th century, and still the popular. So we've sort of gone downhill, I think, in terms of our values, in terms of the movies or plays that we like the very best. If you'll notice, going with the other slides, well, this is a novel that my wife and I found. It took me about 15 years to run down the only extant copy and brought it back, because this was one of many books, Free Flag of Cuba, that Lucy Holcomb Pickens and so many women in the South were writing in response to Uncle Tom's Cabin, the other side up, defending slavery, how wonderful slavery was, and sort of producing this sort of mystification that's going on. Go ahead on through this. You can see the slave cabins are away from the big house. Move on through, Jonathan, and do it. And this is the jumping the broom is one example here. And this is a runaway slave ad, just to sort of contrast that slaves are running away because they do not want to be slaves. And it's sort of an answer to this mystification of the plantation South and the happy slave. And understand the South as other, we must understand that it's inevitably the combined history of blacks and whites, as well as blacks and whites interreacting. Today, as in the past, racial minorities pay a huge price in human suffering as a result of their categorization as other by the dominant racial ideology. Some see the South as a land of unwilling people. African Americans brought here as slaves did not want to come to America, and white Southerners tried to leave the United States, but Kentucky-born Abe Lincoln would not let them leave. So both Southern blacks and Southern whites maybe have a right to share a sense of grieving, but for different reasons. According to sociologist George Simmel, quote, "The stranger is by his very nature no owner of land. Land not only in the physical sense, but also metaphorically as a vital substance which is fixed, if not in space, then at least in an ideal position within the environment. Slaves, of course, could not own land. And after the Civil War, Southern white landowners attempted to control labor arrangements by keeping African Americans from becoming landowners and even renters. Moreover, African Americans were told they were not real Americans. Yet by 1860, almost all had been born in the United States. The ancestors of many whites came to the United States during the 1990s or late 1800s, but most African American families had come prior to 1808. in a strong argument for an exceptional South, still, I think historian Pete Daniel has been carefully studying the records of the Agriculture Department to show the deliberate policy discrimination against black Southern farmers. By providing support, and especially financial assistance, through all the local county boards, which were made up of elites in these Southern rural areas, African Americans did not receive their fair share of the agricultural allotments. This has resulted in African American farmers losing their farms over the years and contribute to a continuation of white supremacy in rural areas. The Pigford court case ruled in favor of African American farmers who sued the governor over this policy, but the lead plaintiff says even today the policy continues under other guises to take land away from black Southerners. In fact, they're gearing up for another case of discrimination right now. And historian Mark Schutz and Adrian Petty are studying black farmers from emancipation to today to see what's happened to the black farmers, with a good example of how institutional racism has affected the lay of the land, particularly in the South, as so many black farmers have lost their farms. Well, it has been our generation of historians who've looked at the history of both blacks and whites in the South, and we've not understood that it's the interaction, actually, that formed both black and white Southerners in the South. No one can deny that African-American formative influence on the culture of the South. Go ahead. I don't know if we saw the one with the banjo there, but I find the banjo the most interesting because that's an African instrument, but no longer really played by African-Americans, but by whites have continued the banjo tradition because of sort of stereotyping race, and so I think we sort of missed that there. The interaction among poor white and black tenants and laborers found its way into popular culture through music. And music is only one of many illustrations of where we feel the interaction of black and white directly. Plantation and work songs, the spirituals, influenced the blues and ragtimes. At the same time, gospel music and hillbilly music was developing among whites in a parallel track. But these interacted with the blues and what became known as rhythm and blues in the 1950s and then became known as soul music. Side stream of this has been rock and roll, and who only knows what different sorts of amalgams and mixtures of music style pop up almost every day. But the result has been a very intricate feedback. The Beatles borrowed very heavily from Elvis Presley, who himself borrowed from and was influenced by black artists like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. Indeed, Southern life from its beginning has been multicultural. Has it been at least triracial since Native American and white interaction in the colonial years? There was much intermarrying between Indians in the 18th century. Daniel Ross, can you go to the slide with the, there we go. Daniel Ross, who was Scottish, to the Cherokee, John Pitchkin, also Scots. He was also George Washington's interpreter of the Choctaw to the Choctaw, William McIntosh to the Creek, among many. Indians also provided land out of Absalom, the Sutpen's Hundred is from Native Americans. After removal now, Indians were romanticized in the South as great Americans. So right here at we have Issaquena Trail, the story of Katiche and all these things. But those with Indian blood who remained in the South were considered colored, and along with the African Americans, otherwise and made internal strangers. So Americans began to share the land with whites and blacks, that is Native Americans, and you find a Sutpen and Absalom getting his land there at least recently. Until the large number of Hispanic additions between Texas and Florida, one could have portrayed perhaps the South as a distinctive imagination of a biracial society of Christian whites, as we saw those slides showing the Protestant domination of religion of Methodist and Baptist from at least 1880 on, in contrast to the multiple imagination of the South. And I want to show you particularly, we can go in here. I love this slide. This slide is actually done by the great Southern writer Eudora Welty. And I don't think you can read what's written. It's 1941. She's 26 years old, and it was published in Vogue magazine. And it's very interesting. Notice this date, 1951. She said, "This is a black church, and on it is written," quote, and they're having school there for African Americans. And I quote, "Mississippi has more color than white people." And it's about voting and voting registration, and she captures that at a special time with the church being used as a school. Interestingly, I think Southern Protestantism, which makes a virtue out of Southern, fits well in the ideology of the South as other and of African Americans as other. Native Americans, Jews, Asian, Mexican Americans have all lived in the South for a long time, but in Southern history, they always seem marginalized. This is particularly important since now, reversing the trend of centuries, the South is attracting foreign immigrants. Today, the South is an amalgam of many, many ethnicities. And for a long time now, decades, African Americans have reversed their out-migration. They're returning to claim a Southern homeland. Tony Horowitz and Confederates in the Attic suggest a total lack of revolutionary transformation in the mind of modern white Southerners. For many, neo-Confederation, segregation, and a myth of history seem to remain the order of the day. But Horowitz is only talking about some white Southerners, and more important, Southern African Americans, especially more recently Hispanic and Asians, are challenging the meaning of the South. They are articulating their view and being heard that the Confederate flag is not their flag, and therefore not the flag of Southerners. Empowered by enforcement of the Voting Rights Act and representing a usually minority-majority electoral district, African Americans are now on the school boards, county and city councils, and in state legislature. Their votes and their voices have to be heard. Moreover, the American South is now benefiting from the contributions of these minority citizens to the dialogues. They bring in their perspective and their resources. And I do think things are changing. Years ago, I was right after the Ken Burns film came out, about 1989, I was asked to debate the Sons of the Confederacy on the film. What had happened, they had actually made Ken Burns an honorary member of the Sons of the Confederacy. That is, before the film came out. When it came out, they were furious because one of the things the film does is make it clear that slavery is the cause of the Civil War. So the Sons of the Confederacy in South Carolina called a boycott of South Carolina educational television. Now, South Carolina educational television, interestingly, was sort of founded in sins when Governor James F. Burns and the state legislature said they would close the schools before they would integrate. They founded South Carolina Educational Television thinking they could educate children through TV, and then blacks and whites would not have to be in the school. That's one of these great ironies that I love, because South Carolina Educational Television became one of the best things to ever help, literally, in race relations. Their programs were used over the world in terms of race relations and made race relations much better. And they couldn't get anyone to really debate the Sons of the Confederacy, so I sort of, as they say, fools rush in where angels don't tread, I came to do it. It was quite an experience. I had not realized, in fact, that they had written the questions, and all but three people were either Sons of the Confederacy, many of them dressed in Confederate uniform, some with swords. Mel Bradford, who was actually considered for NEH, was one of them. I don't know who the other one was. As I said, they had written the questions, which I hadn't seen. I sat between them, didn't get much word in otherwise. Finally, I got in one little remark when I said, I don't know why you brought in these two outside agitators. That's a good word of Southerners, like white Southerners like you, to pick on a good little boy like me from 96 South Carolina. And they assumed I was from Illinois. I was teaching at University of Illinois at the time. But they kept going on and on about how South Carolina had lost the Civil War and how horrible it was South Carolina lost the Civil War. So finally I said, I don't understand this. You're making it sound like South Carolina lost the Civil War. South Carolina didn't lose the Civil War. South Carolina won, and you could have heard a pin drop. And I said, a majority of people in South Carolina wanted the Confederacy to lose. I said, a majority of people in South Carolina, in fact, were enslaved, and they were African Americans, and they wanted a Union win. You can say the state of South Carolina lost, but you cannot say the people of South Carolina lost. And the TV tape station was about like this, that the rose went up. This huge guy got up. It's all caught on TV. So you see it. And he put his fist back. He's got a sword and his sash and his uniform. And he starts down the aisle like this. And he says, you insulted my ancestors. And I said, well, you know, my ancestors were just as stupid as yours. At which point, he literally stopped and sat back down. Now, I'm telling this story because the irony is just last year when I was on a board, in fact, to help commemorate, not celebrate, the firing on Fort Sumter and the sesquicentennial. It was Sons of the Confederacy on this board who asked me to please ask Ken Burns to come back. They now like Ken Burns. As going to, people learn. We can learn. That's one of the things I like the best. That movie's that book and other books that they set. When Haley Barbour said, of course, you'd have to be crazy, the governor of Mississippi just reached, well, about a year ago, to not think that slavery was the cause of the Civil War. We've come a long way from 1989, and I think that is making a difference. And part of that, I think we can take credit as scholars who are doing those sorts of things. And we have to get those ideas out. In fact, others, including some black entrepreneurs in Charleston, South Carolina, are reflecting a new cultural phenomenon, a sort of a postmodernism. They take the Confederate flag, and they've been producing and successfully selling clothing depicting the Confederate flag, but rework with the colors of black nationalism. And again, I don't know why our color scheme is not showing up. I apologize, but if you could see it, it would be those colors instead of there. Indeed, opinion survey find that since the civil rights movement, African American identify themselves as Southerners, thus indicating that Southern identity has shifted from a political identification with the Confederate state to a cultural identity. With that in mind, we need to conceptualize history in new ways to understand the influence of the dominant culture and how the margins help define the center. Finally, the same principle of people's interactions holds true for gender in the South. In patriarchal Southern culture, with its exaggerated stereotypes of masculinity, the role of women is often that of the other. Feminist scholars find that much of intellectual discussion uses gender to portray the other. Quote, furthermore, national as well as regional discursive needs to expand or contain, inflate or diminish, sentimentalize or denigrate the region, in short, to represent the South as other, have used gender as a goal. It's okay to, I was told it was okay to take a break, let the class take a break. Is that all right? Okay, take a quick 5-minute break. I know you need, and we'll finish up, okay? So people can take a quick one, and we'll come right back, and we'll finish this up. I want to talk a little bit about the Southern Belle Primer. Now, this is written by Marilyn Schwartz, and she says that one cannot become a belle without the proper background. Quote, real Southern tradition is taught at birth by doting mothers, aunts, and grandmothers and passed down from generation to generation. An outsider just doesn't have a clue. How many of you saw The Help? Some of this may resonate with you as you remember. One of the rules for Southern belles is, quote, never chew gum in public and never smoke on the street. Another rule is buy low, sell high. An Alabama belle discussing the importance of dancing lessons for little girls says, quote, this is where they first learn to sparkle. One of my favorite is that you can have fake bosoms, eyelashes, and a fake smile, but your pearl and your silver must be real. That's from a grandmother. Well, some of this stereotyping is seen in a lot of books and things, and we think that that is changing as well. Now, Southern culture has traditionally been defined as white male culture. William Faulkner suggested in Light in August in the 1930s that it was the interaction of black and white and the need of white dominance that defined or warped white Southern men's understanding of manhood. That's Dorothea Lange's plantation overseer. In his 1998 novel, A Man in Full, Thomas Wolfe, who I think is one of the most astute commentators on both American and Southern society, has his character, Charlie Croker, say at one point, I never explained myself to servants or to women. White Southerners who viewed the Civil War as a test of manhood lost the war. Did they fail the test? One of my actual favorite stories is about John B. Gordon, who was the man who surrendered the arms at Appomattox Courthouse. And this was written in the newspaper, in the Augusta paper. He had been a politician before the war and been raising troops, and he's now running for governor of Georgia after the Civil War. And an old soldier who has one arm tied up, he'd lost his arm in it, says, hey, I remember you. You're that fellow told us that we could beat those Yankees with corn stalks. And Gordon never missed a beat. And he says, yes, and we could have beat them if they'd have fought us with corn stalks too. So, but if you define the Civil War, think about this, as a test of manhood and you lose, what does that do to you? What does that say? Before the war, white Southerners saw the South as a masculine counterpoint to the effeminate Yankee. Northern victory reversed this relationship and the North became the masculine counterpart to the South as handmaiden. Several studies, all by women scholars, address this theme to a degree, and taken together, I think they provide another instance of a bottom rung reversing positions, only this time with gendered regionalism instead of race. And that's actually one of the reasons it's sort of interesting. I wrote a little book, Gentlemen and Officers, because we have actually learned a lot even about African Americans as slaves, certainly after the war, about women's history. And I thought it was very interesting. We knew very little about sort of the white middle class and those who were never made it, like the Robert E. Lees or Nathan Bedford Forrest or Stonewall Jackson, who I would argue turned the South prematurely gray. That's supposed to be a joke, gray Confederate. Oh, never mind. But who made the South run, like the colonels and others who get to that sort of level? So it's not by chance that the South is the home of hard-nosed football, stark car racing, exaggerated masculine traits. This was an article out of the Daily Illini, where I taught at the University of Illinois, and it says, Elvis Bear and class football, three things dead in the South. And there's a great resentment, of course, of, in fact, football. Do we have our football slide there? Yeah, ooh, boy, the coloring is really off. Michael Powell's worked very hard to get this slide together. It shows, in fact, one line, if you could tell it, shows where the 11 Confederate states and the football teams, the percentage they have won, the top 10 and the top 20 and the other then includes Kentucky and Oklahoma. And if you take each of the decades from 1940 on and the percent of the population they are, Southerners are in fact winning a lot more percentage of football games and titles and in the top 10 than they you would think they would. And this is, of course, when they are not even, it begins even well before you have the integrated teams where you have the great black players. In fact, go to the next slide. I have a fun thing I used to love to ask people at the University of Illinois. What alumni played football at the University of Illinois and ran for president? It's Jesse Jackson, who's from South Carolina, because he could not, in fact, play at a white school. So he went to the Big Ten in Illinois, and you have that was when the Big Ten was so dominant or had their better teams, I think, is when you had so many of these great black players from the South going there to play. But when you look at it, Southern players were no bigger. They were certainly not as fast. And I argue there's only one thing that can make the difference. They were just meaner. And I say that facetiously, but I think that the culture we had in the South, a culture of slavery, a slavery that could only exist if you had violence or the threat of violence, then, in fact, created a culture of sort of what we think of exaggerated masculine cults of credits and things there. I know in reading Michael Jordan's biography, his father tells him when he gets mad to go play with the girls if he cries or something like that. But it's exaggerated Southern traits that come on. I want to rely again on Tom Wolfe, and let's take note of Junior Johnson, who he writes in an essay called The Last American Hero. Johnson was the hard-charging king of the stock car world as a youngster. He learned to drive the North Carolina back roads in his car loaded with mason jars of moonshine. He gained his reputation by racing on the half-mile dirt tracks in the South, where the contest was not so much between the speed and endurance of machines as between the skill and courage of the individual drivers. The winner of these modified hot rod races is a man who gets through the curves the fastest and manages to stay on the track until the end. And you have a slide here of Junior Johnson. But go to W.J. Cash, whose book you read, in fact, in this class. Should be the next one. Nope, Alvin York. Well, we'll get to Alvin York, too. Somehow W.J. Cash is Hell of a Fellow, and the good old boys that are sort of memorialized in literature and country music, a romantic, individualistic hell of a fellow, sort of exemplifies the Southern male, one of the stereotypes of the Southern other. And the reason you have Alvin York there is also this very same area that's produced an inordinate proportion of people who have won the Congressional Medal of Honor out of there, too. Can we go to the next slide? It's Burt Reynolds, good. And this is sort of the image of the good old boy in the series of bandit movies that went on. And I love one thing when Burt Reynolds is explaining to Sally Field, she asks him, what does he do? And he says the best thing he does is show off. And I think that's been another sort of characteristic of white Southern males there as well in the South. And you have these sort of other images of the Dukes of Hazzard and the sort of Beverly Hillbillies come on. In fact, one person said the first time that you had whites presented on TV as sort of realistic and from the South as smart was when you had J.R. in Dallas. Before that, it was sort of the Waltons that was sort of at their best, a sort of a sweet family, but not maybe the sharpest knives in the drawer. But is the South still a regional other? A newspaper reported a story about a local woman who worked with people wanting to tame their Southern accents to allow better career opportunities. Deanne Webb of Corporate Communication was quoted as saying, quote, "We Southerners take a beating because of our accents." She told of an actor who auditioned for a part in the movies. After he had read the script, the director said to him, quote, "Who ever heard of a nuclear physicist with a Southern accent?" Now, President Jimmy Carter and many of those in Tennessee, especially around Oak Ridge, know better. But the myth always seems to trump the reality. There's another side to this, too, though. Jim Lowen, a sociologist who taught at the University of Vermont for years, noticed one day that his neighbor was carrying one of these big cassette players. It was before the little iPods and things like that when you get tapes. Was walking around with something, so he went to ask him what it was. And he said he was a little embarrassed to tell him, but he'd ordered these tapes from Japan. This is true transnationalism, I guess, because he wanted to be a country singer, and these tapes were going to teach him to speak like a Southerner so he could be a country music singer. So sometimes the accents count to help you in your career, I guess. Now, although the history of the 20th century included the integration of the South into the mainstream, opinion survey broken down by region and age group say that the South actually still lives. Surveys show little evidence of a conversion in Southern attitudes and cultural values. Differences in opinions over politics, religion, and morals are more divided along regional lines than along the lines of age, sex, race, religion, and class or urban-rural differences. Furthermore, regional differences have increased, actually, over what we now have is 5 decades worth of evidence. Southerners, as opposed to Northerners, have an intense sense of place and awareness of the past in the present. Or I could say that Southerners love history more. Scores of Southern anecdotal folk tales indicates that a Southern identity exists in opposition to a Northern identity. That is, Southerners know themselves apart from Northerners, and that Southerners can tell themselves apart in or through an opposition to or against Northerners. One such folk tale declares that a Southerner never eats what never sells what he can eat, and a Northerner never eats what he can sell. Some have made a point of the contrast, particularly of race relations in the North and South. Questions of race still tear at the fabric of our supposedly egalitarian society, at our system of justice and law and order. As Attorney General Eric Holder reminded us in what became a rather controversial statement, quote, "In things racial, we have always been, and I believe continue to be, in too many ways essentially a nation of cowards." But race is a part of Abraham Lincoln's unfinished work as spoken in his 2 greatest speeches, the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural. And we're going to actually address those things here at Clemson with some conferences on Lincoln's unfinished work in the next few years. This is Harvey Gantt. This is the first student to integrate Clemson. And I love one of the things that he said. He claimed, if you cannot appeal to the morals of a South Carolinian, you can appeal to his manners. He's talking about whites here. And I've taken that seriously because let's look at Lincoln, who I argue is a Southerner. Like most people in the 19th century, Lincoln used the N-word. He told racist jokes. Now, I don't think that should mean that we shouldn't value his heroic characteristic and efforts. In 1864, a delegation of African-American men came to see Lincoln to request equal pay for black laborers. African-American Henry Samuels remembered the event and how Lincoln listened quietly, and Samuels wrote it down. According to Samuel, Lincoln said in a jocular manner, quote, "Well, gentlemen, you wish the pay of Cuffy raised." Now, the story might have ended there with that patronizing tone of Abraham Lincoln. But this young black man, Samuels, boldly confronted the president that they did not make use of the word Cuffy in their, quote, vernacular, that they were there to request, quote, "the wages of the American colored labor be equalized with those of the American white labor." Lincoln apologized to this young man, the President of the United States. He told Samuels, quote, "I stand corrected, young man, but you know I am by birth a Southerner, and in our section that term is applied without any idea of an offensive nature. But unlike so many of the rest of us, Lincoln got the idea. Lincoln went on to say that he would, quote, at the earliest possible moment, do all in my power to accede to your request. Wages were equalized only a month later. I think this and other collaborating evidence actually shows Lincoln's incredible flexible mind allowed him to grow so that by the end of the Civil War, he's leading the nation to a better place on race. I think that's a good thing to appreciate, to know that people can learn and change. You know, I hate the way we use the term flip-flopper now. We criticize politicians who are flip-flopping. Lincoln was a great flip-flopper. As he learned more, he learned and was willing to say, I'm wrong and I changed my mind and we're going to do better about that as he gathered more information. I think we can grow better on issues when we are open-minded and willing to learn more about them. And I think we can still learn from this Southerner Lincoln. And I think some white Southerners have been learning and are learning as Lincoln learned. There was a story on National Public Radio that quoted a Southern African-American woman as noticing that when she lived in the South, she often stopped by her white neighbor's house and the two of them shared lemonade and conversation together in the backyard, a neighbor who would never have counted equal opportunity for jobs. This black woman, well-employed in the North, and really enjoying her new economic opportunity, nevertheless missed a camaraderie with white friends, which she found sorely lacking in the North. Some make the generalization that Southern whites hate blacks in the abstract, but not on a person-to-person level, whereas Northern whites love blacks in the abstract, but refused to allow face-to-face relationships to develop. Southern rural traditions may actually become the salvation of race relations. Smaller communities and towns, while not ideal in their race relations or tolerance for atypical lifestyles, still have a sense of localized community. These small communities generally have only one school and thus an integrated school system with an integrated sports program. With the South's craziness about sports, as we talked about football particularly, or basketball, which are traditionally considered male virtues, African Americans who excel at those sports have become local celebrities. Everyone sort of likes Mike, like Michael Jordan from North Carolina. People in these small towns and the few rural farming folks left have a sense of community and interaction that can transcend race or lifestyle as a division between people. Farming folks of all colors share concern about the amount of rainfall, the price of cattle, how to deal with pest infections. In spaces that are small enough that there's no anonymity, I believe this tolerance even extends to gay and lesbian relationships. Individuals accepted as part of the community, a member of the church, and the child of a specific people and sibling of other community members. Now, rather than the other being a confirmation of the nation's worst fears, it may become the beacon of its best hopes, repository of foundational values of history, family, faith, liberty, equality, and community. Looking to the Southern other, John Lee Johnston, who's a black leader in Champaign, Illinois, which is home of the University of Illinois where I taught for 34 years, made this point, and I quote, Champaign is unique in that it's unable to come to grips with the racial tensions in the city. It's unable to come to grips and realize it could elect a black man for its mayor. Johnston said, quote, if it was a Southern city, it would be more willing to deal with this racism, end of quote. And in fact, the town I grew up in, 96 South Carolina, has only a 10% voting age that is African American, yet several years back it elected an African American mayor. And 96, which previously had not considered a memorial for Native son Benjamin Mays, has now put up such a marker. Speaking in 96 in 1981, Ben Mays said, quote, yes, Lord, South Carolina has changed. He was also inducted in the South Carolina Hall of Fame. In November 1981, dignitaries, including Coretta Scott King, together with white and black home folk, gathered a ceremony to name the intersection of Scott Ferry Road with U.S. Highway 178, 600 feet from his birthplace, Mays Crossroad, and a tall granite marker pays tribute to Mays as one of the state's, quote, most distinguished Native sons, one of the great forces for civil rights, not only in this country, but around the world, end of quotation. Now his boyhood home has been moved from out in the country in 96, preserved as a museum in the county seat of Greenwood. Mays has now actually become a tourist attraction that brings visitors into the area, and through the memorials to him, we learn about the heroics of the African-American freedom struggle, and we find a different Southern hero to model our lives and values upon. And you can see, though, we still have this contested history. This is Brooks County, Georgia, named after none other than Preston Brooks. So the South is still considered the other, As we begin with the quintessential early Southern statesman, Jefferson, I want to talk about Strom Thurmond, particularly since we're here at Clemson and since you did such a good job on his daughter presenting on her today. It seems appropriate to quote, it seems to me, the most enduring of the 20th century Southern politician. Until his death in the 21st century, Senator Strom Thurmond celebrated his region as the other, a superior other. And I quote, a long quote, so bear with me. "Well, I think we've got good people in all parts of the country. But I still go back to the fact that I think it's the most patriotic part of the country. I think it's because we haven't had all these immigrants come down with different ideas and theories, and some of them contaminate in their own way. I think it's the soundest thinking part of the nation. And I think that's been evidenced by they haven't allowed these unions to come in and take over like they have in some places. I think the majority of them," he means Southern people here, "love their country. They worship God. And the family life is sounder, although it's not what it could be. But families are held together better, generally speaking." Of course, he had his own family problems later in his life. And as we saw, one of the things that's changed in the South is divorce rates have gone up in the South, so they're ahead instead of behind the rest of the Union. Then Strom Thurmond continues about Southern people. "They feel an interest in each other. If you go down in the South, the people are friendly. Most of them will want to talk to you on the street. They'll give you any advice, help they can. If you break down in an automobile, they'll stop and help you." And I can testify to this because every month I drove home to see my mother in 96 South Carolina from Banner, Illinois. And we could tell if we were in the South or not because I would have to pay an arm and a leg where I broke down to get help. And I'd have to insist people take money after I got down into the South to if they helped me. And I could tell story after story on that. "Well, you just don't find that in a lot of places in other parts of the country," Thurmond says. "I'm proud to be Southern because I think those people, I guess it's what I believe in, I think they're military-minded, and I think that's essential if you're going to maintain your freedom. You've got to be willing to fight for it. Then I'm proud, too, because, for instance, people down there seem to think more alike. I don't think too much about the past, except I like to study the past because if you don't study history and know some history, you can't judge the future." Now, if we move, go back for me, going back. This is part of a memorial to African Americans on the State House grounds in South Carolina. It's no individual monument to an African American on the State House grounds at South Carolina. And if you look closely, you can figure out who some of the people here are, including Judge Matthew Perry, or in fact astronaut Robert McNair. But there is not one. And I think it's good that that's there, representing about a third of the population, but I also think it's time that we recognize, like with May's home in 96, the contributions of African Americans in this contested history and society of ours. Now, go ahead, Jonathan. This is Strom Thurmond's statue, and I took this earlier, and it has his four children listed there. And what has changed is, in fact, with, go to the next one, they have gone back to that statue and added his African American daughter, which I think is a wonderful thing for the family to have done. They've added Esther Williams' name to Strom Thurmond's children there. As far as I can tell, she is the only African American whose name is there on the State House grounds. And I think that, in fact, if you look at the State House grounds, let's go on to the next slides here. This was from a postcard. This is when the Confederate flag flew over the State House grounds. And I've said, this is where we really learn our history going forward. It's no longer there. It's been taken down. You can barely see it here. It's by the Confederate statue, but it's in front. And that's still a bone of contention why the NAACP is still boycotting the thing there. Go forward, though. This is Wade Hampton. This is the man who led what people like to call the redemption that I don't like to call it, would call it the restoration, Civil War hero. Go to the next one. This is Pitchfork Ben Tillman, of course, one of the founders of our school here at Clemson. He represents one thing to white people, very different, in fact, to African Americans. He stood for white supremacy, and he is usually seen as a prototype of the white Southern demagogue who used race to divide and against African Americans. And go to the next one. And this is James F. Burns. James F. Burns was one of the most brilliant of politicians. He started off a poor Irish kid who never even finished school, and yet he almost became president. He was on the Supreme Court, congressman, Senate, called the Cardinal Richelieu of the Senate. FDR asked him to come off the Supreme Court and sort of run the domestic home front. He was domestic president in World War II, became Secretary of State, and came close to being president. And then afterwards, he comes back to fight integration in South Carolina. He's the main leader of it. So for all his brilliance and the great politician, he also represents the fight to maintain segregation in South Carolina. So it's important what we memorialize. We'll go right here. This is, in fact, one of those great heroes that I was talking about. This is Reverend Delaney. And Reverend Delaney, in fact, was the man who was most responsible for what comes Brown v. Board. South Carolina is really famous in American history, I think, central to two things. We know about the Civil War. We can't miss it. But also Brown v. Board, which really begins to end segregation with 1954, begins in South Carolina. And this is the man, the pastor, who's African-American, who really did this, risked his life, had to flee the state as a fugitive, and never got to come back. He died in Charlotte, as close as he could come without coming back into the state of South Carolina that he loved so much. The next couple is a couple, the Briggs, Harry Briggs and his wife, who as families were the people who signed that petition to begin what becomes Brown v. Board right here in Clarendon, South Carolina. I would argue we need monuments to them on the State House ground in South Carolina, like people in all the southern states do, to explain what this contested history is. Now, there are so many people that could stand out as role models. I don't think, as a lot of people do, that you deny your history. We accept our history and we move from there. I got a lot of teasing about moving to Clemson from the land of Lincoln to where? On the plantation of John C. Calhoun, who's the man who introduced the idea that slavery is not a necessary evil, but that it's a positive good. And that brought people like Lincoln, who could live with the idea that we had to live with slavery, but it was evil. But if it's a positive thing, that's the best thing in the world, you cannot. And, of course, we talked about Tillman as the founder of Clemson, the governor who really made it happen. And then they put me in Strom Thurmond's office. In Strom Thurmond Institute, actually. And so when these lawyers called me about this case, they wanted to know, had I gone to the dark side? And I said, no, I actually love Clemson. I do not want to deny it. I was asked when I was interviewed here, well, I guess you'd want to tear down Tillman Hall. I said, no, let's just build a hall, Gant Hall, much bigger and nicer. It's part of our heritage. And what I love about Clemson is that we're doing such wonderful things. And that's what I think we can learn. That's the point, I think, one of the lessons of history. You can learn from your history. So now we have the Mr. Program, which is making it possible for African Americans to go to Clemson if they'll teach in the schools. And we have a diversity officer. So if we at Clemson can lead the way in this, then others can change as well. Now, we are consciously aware of those who embrace their history, celebrate it, and take it as uncritical. My history, my country, or region, for us, the South, right or wrong. But for many Southerners before my generation, and certainly those who came of age with me with segregation, the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, many of us have been crippled by the guilt of the tragedy and the horribleness of our region's history, especially the treatment of African Americans by white. Now, I don't think either way this sort of celebratory of my region, right or wrong, or just so torn up you can't do it, is the right way you read history. I want to suggest that you need to have an ambiguous reading and get some distance from your history, and it's much better than the two alternative. And if there's no longer a South, while I think there is a South, and you can write on your exam whatever you want, but I still think there is a South. But if you believe not, that's okay. I still think there's much we can learn from the lessons of Southern history. And I want to look at two of the greatest modern Southern historians and some of the lessons from Southern history they've taught us that I think are examples of larger meanings of history that I hope you got out of this course. Both C. Van Woodward and Eugene Dinovesi have shown us through their research and writings that Southern distinctiveness does not have to lead to neo-Confederate conservative craziness in any automatic way. Quite the contrary, and those distinctive qualities, as Jean Genovese has insisted, albeit in some rather perverse ways, point toward a better future for all Americans, or they can. Throughout our course this semester, we've discussed who gets to be American and how that process changed over time as definition of gender, whiteness, sexuality, class, and acceptable political affiliation changed. Throughout the course, the role of the South as an un-American place kept popping up everywhere. For example, even in today's conservative political climate, when socialism is deemed the acme of all this un-American, it is supposedly the politically most conservative South that's the real heartland of socialism. On U.S. military bases, which provide government-run, single-payer health care, pensions, daycare, education, job training, anti-discriminatory housing, shopping, and worship, better banking and car insurance, even halfway decent treatment for gay and lesbian folks, and quite a few local communities, almost like Canada, with guns. And in most communities, these military bases are the linchpin of the local economy. To me, that's a real contradiction and with not a little irony. Now, both Genovese and Woodward are also speaking to a concern of the Southern agrarians. Although Frank Owsley was a great historian, he inspired me to study what he called the plain folk. He was also frighteningly conservative, and historians have now shown that he was all quite racist. But for those fugitive poets and agrarian writers, they got another part, I think, of their message right. And not only for the 1930s and 40s when they were writing, but profoundly for us today as well. And that is, the God of Mammon is going to rob our soul. Southern history should teach us that we can live better than we do. Well, it took a Southerner who went out of the South, C. Van Woodward, to break the planter hold on the American imagination. I sometimes sat with Van before he died at conferences. He couldn't hear well, even with his hearing. He'd ask me to explain things to him. And I was at a conference with him, and the conference had particularly talked about gender and race. And Woodward finally said, well, there's a third thing that you aren't talking about and we should be talking about. Well, I assumed he was going to say class because he had written out of the Charles Beardian tradition. He was the author of one of the great books of all time, Origins of the New South, about class. But instead, don't you have to understand regionalism as well? And I think that's a lesson for us. Woodward used history to change history. His strange career of Jim Crow actually came out of his work as an expert witness in the Brown v. Board court case. Now, Quentin came away to Harvard to tell his story. At least Faulkner had him do that, as did the principal Southern agrarians of I'll Take My Stand of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. So while outside his native region, Woodward broke the hold of the plantation legend. He's the insider who comes away and looks back and interprets the South. Woodward used irony as an explanatory tool. Woodward taught us through Tom Watson and his complicated black and white populace that these are actually modified heroes who struggled against all odds for a cause they believed in. That even though the populace lost their struggle, their heroism was in standing up to overwhelming forces to champion for economic and some political and social justice for blacks and whites. I think it's something we need to be aware of today when we look at who we celebrate and say are important and the heroes we want to aspire to be. Woodward was a pioneer of Southern history and historiography because of his ability to introduce irony, sort of a way of holding incompatible terms and tensions with each other. Of course, he had to go north and endure strangeness and his own strangeness in order to come to his great thesis and work. Now, Eugene Genovese is a northerner who comes south. Genovese's and Woodward's two interpretations of the antebellum and postbellum South, I think, dovetail in very interesting ways. You have Jean Genovese as the counterpoint, the outsider that is a stranger to the South, who looked at the South. He became a captivated carpetbagger that comes south and never leaves. He became the true believer. Planters and the plantation myth wove such a seductive story that it seduced this great Marxist historian Genovese, who'd once been a communist. Genovese saw a theoretical argument for a plantation system that worked as an alternative to capitalist industrial system of the North, where what was most important was self-interest and finance. Genovese moved from communism to conservative Christian Catholic, and also in the process, he studied the faith and theology of Southerners, both African Americans and the white upper classes. Genovese understands the importance of religion and faith, and he helped make religion probably the hottest topic in the profession today when it had been taboo when I was a graduate student. I know I centered religion in my father's house of many mansions as I did in the age of Lincoln. But in the first time when I did, I was told not to. The historians did not look at religion. And I have never understood why we waited so long to get interested in it until now to actually get excited about the importance of religion. Religion is the only thing I know that people will give up water for, will give up food for, will give up sleep for, will give up their life for, and even give up sex for, so it's important. This is from the Greenwood Index Journal. It's a true story. As I told you, I drove, in fact, every month to see my mother, as long as she was alive, from Illinois. A good 12 hours, should have been a 14-hour drive. I got a few speeding tickets, but often I didn't. And we'd drive all night. We had five daughters, on a assistant professor, associate professor, and even early professor's salary. We didn't have much money, so they never got to go out. So we would actually stop at a Burger King about 9 o'clock, and then I would drive all night. We had the last of the great old three-seater Oldsmobile wagons. We would lay down the seats and put them in sleeping bags and line them up. So it was a great treat for them to eat, and I would listen to a book on tape and drive all night. And I had gotten there one night, and my mother said, "You need to go over and speak to Hilton. He's been wanting to talk to you." And I said, "Well, Mom, I'm really tired. Couldn't I wait till tomorrow?" And those of you from the South know when you say a neighbor, you're not really that close. It's a little further down the road. She said, "No, you better go do it." So I went over. Now, Hilton Lewis, J. Hilton Lewis, was a bear of a man. He was a huge man. His father had been a sawmill man, and he had two. And to hear Hilton tell it, he had single-handedly won World War II. But it really bothered me when I was growing up. Hilton was a terrible racist. An interesting thing happened, which is a good sign for the South, actually. He became the best friend of Big Jim Thompson's, an African-American. Now, they were inseparable. They became best friends. They had to ride to Augusta, where the medical hospital was for veterans. And Big Jim had a big Cadillac that was the best riding car in town. And so Hilton and he became inseparable. I mean, and Hilton not only changed from an extraordinary racist, but to a champion of black rights. He just didn't stop saying bad things. He got on to people who did and things. As I walked up to speak, the two of them were sitting on this big swing. And Hilton was an inventor. He had a couple of inventions and patents, made some money off of them. He had taken springs out of the cotton mill and hung them up on the hooks on the ceiling so these swing would bounce with these two huge men in it. And I didn't want to interrupt them, so they were talking. So I sat down on the stoop. And before anything else, I'd barely sat down, two men drove up, Bubba Summers and Pee Wee Ellison. And Pee Wee Ellison's boys had played on the football team. Me and Alva was in my class, Bubba's daughter. They jumped out of the car, and Bubba immediately hollered out to Hilton, "Hilton, did you hear about that murder that was down in Saluda County? I think it was in Troy, or it might have been, I don't know, at the crossroads. This guy, he either shot or he stabbed." At which point Hilton stopped him. He said, "Well, no, I hadn't heard about it until now when I got the details." So what you've now, as you have heard about it, but you haven't got the details of Southern history, you're going to have to get that out of these books and put them on your final exam. So that's the end of our lecture.
Next week, American History TV's Lectures in History takes you to Alfred University in New York as we sit in on Professor Gary Ostrower's class on World War II. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.